from the big island of Hawaii to your radio for Thursday, May 17th, 2018. You're listening to another edition of Weekly Science Program Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm your host, Will Cushman. Unless you're living in a really well-fortified news bubble, you probably should know by now that Kilauea volcano on the big island of Hawaii has been really forcefully erupting over the last 2 weeks. Lava flows have destroyed dozens of homes and forced evacuation of almost 2,000 residents on the Big Island. Meanwhile, just this morning, a large steam-generated eruption launched ash and debris more than 5 miles into the atmosphere, according to the Washington Post and the Hawaii Volcano Observatory. So what's driving this eruption? What's making Kilauea, or what makes Kilauea, excuse me, different from other famous volcanoes that you might know about, like Mount St. Helens in Washington? What are the risks to local residents, and how do scientists try to forecast those risks? Tonight, we're discussing all things volcanoes with our guest, Brad Singer, who is a professor of geoscience at UW-Madison. Brad, among other research, uses high-precision geochronology methods in his pursuit to understand several geologic phenomena, including linking the long-term evolution of volcanoes to current states of activity. As a former geologist and volcano nerd myself, I am very excited to have Brad joining us tonight. Brad, welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine.
Thanks, Will. Good to be here.
So my first question for you is, our listeners might have just heard me say geochronology, and they could, I think, probably surmise a little bit about what that entails. But I'm wondering if you could explain to us what geochronology is and how maybe within the context of some of your specific research.
Yeah, broadly speaking, geochronology is the science of determining the time of formation of rocks that make up the Earth. And we could be talking about the entirety of Earth history if we wanted to be. There are people who specialize in the geochronology of the earliest parts of Earth's formation, 4.57 billion years ago. My specialty is looking at the more recent parts of Earth history leading up to the present. So I apply what are called radioisotopic dating techniques in geochronology to determine the times of eruptions of lava flows and volcanic explosive deposits that form volcanoes. I've actually worked in Hawaii, but not on the subaerial parts of Hawaii. We've applied techniques in my argon laboratory. We use isotopes of potassium and argon to date rocks to look at the submarine west rift of Mauna Loa, in fact.
And Mauna Loa, that's across the main island, right?
Mauna Loa is the...
or the big island.
Before Kilauea became active, Mauna Loa was the main center of growth. It still got some activity, but the activity has shifted southward on the big island to Kilauea in the last few thousands of years. And Mauna Loa is the tallest of the volcanic edifices at Hawaii. And in our work on, for example, our work on this on the south west rift zone of Mauna Loa, the submarine part of it, if you want to get to the earliest history of the volcano, you've got to apply these radioisotopic dating techniques to determine the ages of these submarine eruptions. And I think we got back to about 650,000-700,000 years before present. That's when Mauna Loa started to grow and become this enormous shield volcano. But we use geochronology in looking at volcanoes to determine the eruptive history in great detail. And we can do this with a variety of methods. The method I use in my laboratory is based on the decay of potassium to argon. So we measure the isotopes of argon and minerals in these lavas, and we can get very precise ages from the last few hundreds of thousands of years down to the last few thousands of years. If you want to look at very recent Earth history, we have to shift techniques. And the one that's been applied quite heavily in Hawaii, in the Big Island and elsewhere in the archipelago for young eruptions is radiocarbon. And that can work very well, provided you have the right materials, for about the last 45,000 years, down to a few hundred years.
How does that work?
Radiocarbon is a very different chronometer. The potassium-argon clock that I use in my lab is based on the decay of potassium 40, the isotope potassium 40 to argon 40. And so what we come along and do is basically measure the potassium and argon ratio, and that gives us ages for these minerals. So that's just a simple decay clock. The parent isotope is decaying to a daughter isotope and building up. Radiocarbon has a fairly complicated pathway of production in the atmosphere from cosmic ray bombardment of the upper atmosphere. Some nitrogen is converted to this radioactive isotope of carbon-14, which is a rare isotope of carbon. Most carbon on Earth is carbon-12. And the radiocarbon atoms decay. The half-life is about 5,700 years. And if an organism like a plant or an animal respires CO2 from the atmosphere, that's going to have the radiocarbon concentration of the atmosphere at the time that that's happening. But when the organism dies and stops interacting with the biosphere, atmosphere, the radiocarbon starts to decay. And we can look at the decay down to zero of the parent isotope left. So it's a decay clock. It's a decay clock only. And so it's very good if you have organic material. In Hawaii, it's used to date things like plants that are overrun by lava flows and burned, and just they're dead because the lava flow has torched them. And you can dig underneath the lava flow and find seeds and grass and soils and pieces of wood that were turned into charcoal by the flow. And that's when the clock started, the decay clock started becoming active. And you can date the flows. And you can look at flows down to even in the last few hundreds of years with radiocarbon.
Gotcha.
And then what the goal is in some of our research is to link these kind of paleo records, these geologic records over hundreds to tens of thousands of years to hundreds of years into the historical record. And then we can start to use the whole chronology for the last few thousands of years to figure out how, for example, Kilauea grew, you know. And so that's key. What we'd like to do is, you know, the chronology alone is interesting. Mm-hmm. I get fascinated by just looking at the evolution. These volcanoes tend to be kind of punctuated. You have, you know, highlights and high active periods like today at Hawaii.
Right.
And then it goes into a lull and nothing happens for millennia. And then it happened. Then there's another series of eruptions. But what's important is we can determine all kinds of other properties of the magma that's feeding these eruptions. The chemical composition of the lavas and the minerals in the lavas can give us clues about what's happening at particular periods of time that have fed these eruptions. And by looking at the geochemical evolution, the changes in the chemistry over time, we can start to think about dynamically and mechanically what's going on that's fueling the times when eruptions are happening versus not.
Gotcha.
So
I guess, could you contextualize a little bit the current activity that's going on at Kilauea? It's part of an eruption that's been going on since 1983, correct?
Correct, yeah. There was an eruption in 1955 from within the area. Part of it was in the area that's being affected today, tens of kilometers to the east of Kilauea. But there was a resurgence in activity in 1983 at the summit area of Kilauea, the top of this volcano. Kilauea is the youngest of the volcanoes on the Big Island. There are actually five different volcanoes that make up the Big Island. The previous most active volcano, Mauna Loa, is just to the north of Kilauea, and the whole Hawaiian island is growing southward with more and more volcanic activity. I don't recall exactly how long Kilauea has been growing, but certainly several tens of thousands of years Kilauea has been active. So this 1983 eruption is just one of many hundreds, if not thousands, of eruptions that have occurred to grow Kilauea over the last few thousands of years. And it began in 83 with magma filling up part of the crater at the top of the volcano, and Also, there was an eruption at Puyo'o, I believe, this flank vent about 15 kilometers to the east.
Flank vent being just like a side.
It's down at lower elevations, slightly lower elevations, down on the flanks of the shield. So Kilauea is one of the is a shield volcano. It's a very low aspect ratio volcano in terms of its height to width. So the magmas are very low viscosity. And they can, as you've seen in the news and in the video that you see on TV, the magma is very runny.
Right.
What was it described as by my colleague Mike Karski at University of Hawaii? Killer molasses. You know, it moves very fast. It's very hot, and it can flow, not quite like water would flow, but you know, it can flow very rapidly. There's very little resistance to the flow in this high temperature. You know, we're talking about 1100 to 1200 degrees centigrade material. And so that leads to this form of volcanoes called shield volcanoes that don't build up these very steep-sided conical shapes like Mount St. Helens and Mount Rainier and Mount Shasta in California that people are familiar with. Those are made up of much more viscous, much higher silica, much cooler magmas when they erupt, and the magmas just simply can't flow very far, very rapidly, so they pile up around the vent, and that's what leads to these big conical systems that we see in the Cascade Range in California, Oregon, and Washington, for example. Hawaii, the volcanoes are much wider and less tall for their aspect ratios. So it's a shield volcano, but there is a slope to it, and the summit vent, Kilauea, is where this big steam eruption took place this morning. But at slightly lower elevations, you've got a vent that's connected to the magma that's also feeding the Kilauea mm-hmm. crater called Puyo'o. And I guess last week, the Puyo'o vent collapsed inward. The pressure of magma that was holding that vent open relaxed as it did at the summit because they're connected to one another at depth. And the magma reservoir is talking to itself through these two skylight windows. And they both kind of started having new activity. And at the same time, I gather from the news that I've looked at in the last week, magma also began to flow even farther downslope into Leilani Estates, even 10 more kilometers to the east. And that's where it's pressuring and overpressuring the landscape and bursting out in fissures and fractures in people's yards and across roads and things. And
right. This
has been happening for several days now. I think this is more or less correct, is it's like an artesian water system. You've got the magma was being supplied to a very high elevation at Kilauea, to a lesser elevation at Puyo'o, and there's a pressure head on the magma reservoir, and that pressure is pushing magma downhill, and it's exploiting pre-existing fault systems and weaknesses that have been known to exist since people have been visiting Hawaii. They've noticed that these lava flows erupt and are fed by linear fissure systems. They're basically big faults. And when these faults open up, that's when magma can get to the surface. And that's exactly what's happening now down at the lower elevations.
Right.
The Hawaii Volcano Observatory, one of the things I learned is they have a very dense monitoring network. They use seismology to look at the magma reservoir and how it's behaving, but they also use GPS and other forms of satellite geodesy, and it's pretty clear that these fracture and fault systems along this eastern rift system are extremely active, and they've been active for hundreds of years. And there are many historically documented lava flows that are adjacent to where these eruptions are taking place today. So it's no real big mystery that there would be future eruptions in this area. And if you look at the GPS data, it shows that Kilauea is kind of spreading such that the volcanic edifice, the shield volcano, is growing to the south. It's kind of failing into the Pacific Ocean southward, and that's what's opening up these fissures that's allowing the magma to reach the surface and form lava, for fire fountains of lava and lava flows.
Right. I'm wondering if you could, we could go back real quickly and talk a little bit more about how the viscosity, essentially the thickness of the magma, kind of affects the type of volcano and why Hawaii is a shield volcano with low viscosity magma versus the stratovolcanoes in the Pacific Northwest. Like why do they have higher viscosity? And then maybe talk a little bit about the different hazards that those volcanoes present.
Right. This is an excellent question that also looks like it's starting to be addressed by the news media, because we have this fairly recent example of an explosive eruption, a very large explosive eruption at Mount St. Helens in May of 1980. And people are starting to compare it to what's going on at Kilauea. Hawaii, the volcanic archipelago in Hawaii is fed by and fueled by basaltic magma. This is the product of the melting of mantle rocks below the crust and that are rising below the Big Island of Hawaii. And as they rise and decompress and the pressure is released from these deep rocks, we're talking 50 miles below the Earth's surface, these upwelling rocks are beginning to melt. And when they melt, they form basalt. But basalt is a magma that's very low in silica and richer in magnesium and iron. And that doesn't allow certain types of bonds to form between the elements. It prevents those bonds from forming. And it means that the magma maintains this low viscosity state. It's in other words, there's very little resistance to flow because there are very few of these bonds between silicon and oxygen and the metal ions that make up these magmas, these basaltic magmas. So it can flow and it maintains a very high temperature. Upon eruption, the magmas in Hawaii are typically 1,150 or degrees centigrade or hotter. And that means there also the temperature plays a role. That makes the magma very low in viscosity, so it'll flow very readily. And so these lava flows that do erupt in Hawaii can flow for tens or dozens of kilometers with no problem. If they're erupted up high, they're going to follow topography and river channels and flow just like water would, trying to get all the way down to the coastline if they can. That's what's been happening for the last 30 years there.
Right.
The other N-member type of magmas are much more rich in silica. So magmas that you may have heard the names for, like andesite, dacite, and rhyolite, these magmas are so rich in silica and so poor in magnesium and iron that most of the magma is made of silicon and oxygen atoms. And when you have that chemistry, the silicon and oxygen bond together and form a network that is very resistant to flow. It stiffens the magma up and it becomes much, much more viscous. We're talking 6-7 orders of magnitude more viscous magmas, andesites, dacites, and rhyolites than basalt.
So what type of consistency is that?
It's hard, unless you've seen one of these things erupting, and I've been fortunate to see a couple of silicic magma eruptions. Everyone's familiar with what's going on in Hawaii because that's the most active volcano in the world, Kilauea. Right. And we see on the news, you can see these rivers of molten lava. It's not hard to imagine. These silicic magmas are so viscous in many cases, they kind of move like a big pile of rocks being bulldozed through the landscape at slow speed. I mean, it sounds like a building being bulldozed over and blocks. The magmas are also much cooler. We're talking temperatures between 650 to more like 900 degrees centigrade. So that also stiffens the magmas up. So the magma, as it's trying to flow at the surface, it's freezing and cooling into big rigid blocks. And then more magma comes up and pushes the block to the side and it starts to fall apart. So it's literally bulldozing a pathway through the landscape at very slow speeds. And we do have now some historically documented silicic lava flows, and this is how they behave. They just you know, they move much more slowly. In neither case are the lava flows the biggest hazards that people really face in these, even the fast moving lava streams. We know where these things are going to go once the eruption starts. You can get out of the way. You can you see people working around them. Same thing for the silicic flows. The big difference is that the chemical bonding and the viscosity of basalts means that that type of magma can't store a lot of water, molecular water in its structure, and that's not the same for the more silica-rich magmas. Those magmas, because of the framework of silicon and oxygen that forms, they can actually start to hold on to a lot of hydrogen. And the hydrogen means there's water being stored in the magma. And water, when you decompress the magma and take the pressure off, in other words, when the magma rises towards the surface, eventually that water can't be stored as a component in the chemistry of the melt, and it comes out as bubbles, and that's what makes the silicic magmas much, much more explosive. So it's the analogy is pretty good. You know, it's like if you shake up a bottle of Coke and open it quickly, that's what's happening inside of a decompressing silicic magma. All the water that's normally dissolved in the liquid when it's under pressure comes out when you release the pressure, and it forms an explosion. And that's what happened at Mount St. Helens, essentially. There was a landslide at Mount St. Helens the morning of May 18th that released the pressure on this column of magma that was sitting below the top of the volcano. And as soon as the pressure was released, the magma expanded because the bubbles wanted to get bigger, and it just blew the top of the volcano off. And it actually was directed northward because of the way the landslide moved. So silica-rich magmas can form extremely violent explosive eruptions by a variety of mechanisms. It's less common for large explosive eruptions at basaltic volcanoes.
So what happened this morning at Kilauea with the pretty explosive eruption there?
So this was something that was surprising to me, and maybe surprising for the audience here. I'm not an expert on Kilauea. My research is mostly focused on these more silica-rich volcanoes in the Andes these days, and I've worked on many of them, and so I'm less familiar with Kilauea. So I've read a lot and talked to colleagues who do work there, and it seems that the explosions, at least at Kilauea, at the Halemaumau vent, which is the currently active part of the bigger Kilauea crater at the top of the volcano, what happens is magma comes to the surface of that crater, and it might spill out on the floor of the bigger crater. But when the magma recedes and starts to drain away from that crater system, which is what happened last week, two things can happen. And I don't know if it's absolutely clear what happened this morning. Two things can happen, evidently. Number one, the walls of the crater are very steep, and we're talking several hundreds of feet of vertical relief. And I think the crater got to be 800, almost 1,000 feet wide at one point. And what happens is when the lava lake subsides, the crater walls are unstable, and there's big blocks of formerly active lava flows that have cooled now, and there are blocks of them the size of this table or larger fall into the lava lake. And when they hit the lava lake, they disaggregate and disturb the lava, and they also have maybe rainwater in them, a little bit of water, and it stirs up the gases that are in the lava lake and causes small to modest explosions. I think that the observatory, the volcano observatory, believes that the eruption this morning was triggered by another process. I'm not sure they know yet, but it was a much bigger eruption than these more modest size eruptions. Right. What happens is the conduit that the magma is coming up to that connects the magma chamber at depth with the surface, the conduit for that is extremely hot around the edges, and no water can be close to that conduit. It's being driven away because the temperatures are so high. But when the level of the lava lake that's in the crater descends several hundred feet, it can go below the groundwater table. So there's groundwater everywhere. We have it in it's most of our drinking water in Wisconsin. We drill wells to get water. Well, you know, if you drop the level of the lava lake below the top of where water is in all the pore spaces in the lavas, in Hawaii, it rains a lot. There's a lot of groundwater. That water can come in to the sides of the conduit and flood the top of the magma reservoir. And I think that's probably what happened this morning. And that triggered a very large, what we call a phreatic eruption. That means a water-driven eruption. The water, as soon as it hits 1,100, 1,200 degrees centigrade magma, it flashes to steam and creates an explosion. That is likely what happened this morning.
Gotcha.
So if the lava lake keeps, you know, you can imagine different scenarios, but if the lava lake keeps moving around and interacting with the groundwater system, you could have these explosions going on quite often. I learned from work that my colleague at the University of Hawaii is supervising one of his students on that, and I didn't know this until this morning, yesterday and this morning, over the last 400 or 500 years, 60% of the eruptions at Kilauea have been explosive, and only 40% have been lava flows like the ones that are endangering the Leilani estates now. So in fact, the propensity is during the last 500 years that many, many eruptions at Kilauea are explosive and probably phreatically generated by the interaction of water with the magma.
Interesting.
Much more often than people think. We just happen to live in a time since the last 200 years when people have been on the island where most of the eruptions have been effusive, and particularly skewing towards effusive eruptions of lava in the last century. And that's just, we don't know if that's an accident, but it's just the way things are. So we're more experienced as humans living on Hawaii with these lava flows. But Hawaii can produce pretty significant explosive eruptions too.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. But we have only like 30 seconds left, but I think we were discussing a news article that we both saw today of comparing like Kilauea could be the next Mount St. Helens, and it could be explosive, but not quite level.
Yeah, it's really the amount of water that can be stored in the magma when it's very silica rich. That's a different ball game. These phreatic eruptions extinguish themselves once the eruption starts. Then the fuel is gone, and you remove the water quickly. There are places on Earth, like at Santiago volcano in Guatemala, it erupts very frequently phreatically. The rain falls right into a silicic vent there. It has modest explosions that are very regular. But when the water is actually water that's dissolved in the magma and stored as a gas phase, as bubbles separated from the melt, these tend to be very, very explosive systems, and they can create eruptions much larger and much more sustained than the one you saw this morning at Kilauea.
Right. Well, Brad, thanks a lot. This has been a really interesting half hour. We are about out of time. But thanks again to Brad Singer of UW-Madison's Department of Geoscience. And thank you, as always, to our listeners for tuning into another edition of Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm your host and producer of tonight's show, Will Cushman, and our engineer this evening has been Dave Harker. Be sure to tune in next Thursday, May 24th, for another episode of Perpetual Notion Machine.